Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, radio audience. Welcome back to the Work in Progress seminar series after your Easter break, which I hope you had, or managed to get some days off anyway. It gives me great pleasure to welcome tonight's speaker. Michael DeGuara is a graduate of the anthropology program. He graduated first class honors in anthropology in 2002, writing his BA honors dissertation on male homelessness in Malta. And then in 2006-2007, he was at University of Cambridge, where he completed a Master in Philosophy degree in Social Anthropological Analysis. And his MA thesis for Cambridge was on the social implications of the revival of traditional music and dance in southern Italy. And some of the issues he is going to be dealing with tonight grow out of that MPhil dissertation. But Michael is continuously involved in the whole question of youth culture and the revival of traditional culture in southern Italy. And tonight he is going to speak on the topic Rethinking Southern European Identities, the Revival of Traditional Dances and Social Reflexivity in Salento. So welcome, Michael.
Thanks, Paul, for that introduction, and thank you all for coming. Yes, so the topic today will be Rethinking Southern European Identities, the Revival of Traditional Dances and Social Reflexivity in Salento. I would like to start with two anecdotes taken from my first visit to Salento in 2004. At the time, I was not yet doing field work. I was a participant in a cultural exchange program. However, these two episodes occurred, which gave me a glimpse of the Janus-like nature of the phenomenon that I will be discussing. The first anecdote takes place in the town of San Nicola, which is in the province of Lecce in Puglia in Italy. And a rapid, incessant 6-8 rhythms filled the village square. The tempo was kept by two tambourines, which were in turn accompanied by a violin, a guitar, and a powerful voice singing invocations to St. Paul. All this to a very lively melody in a major key. The local participants took the opportunity to teach the foreign visitors the basic moves of the dance known as the pizzica. We'll discuss it in further detail later on. And yet, it was evident that at least for some of the participants, the dance was not just a choreo to present to tourists or to foreigners, but a powerful embodied experience, a very personal experience. One of the local participants replied when complimented on her dancing, "When I dance to this music, I never feel tired." Indeed, several of the local participants talked about this dance as a liberating and energizing exercise, different from other dance forms, recalling one of the traditional settings in which this music was played. Despite the lively tune, in fact, the lyrics were clearly an invocation to St. Paul to help someone who had been bitten or pinched in the heart and was in some form of agonizing pain. Indeed, although the recording being played dated back only to 1997, this was the music that for centuries had been used in the therapeutic ritual cure for tarantism, an illness attributed to the bite of a venomous spider known in the vernacular as Taranta, whence also the name Tarantella. The only cure for this mysterious melody was in fact to induce those who succumbed to it, called Tarantati, to dance, sometimes for days on end, and invoke the help of St. Paul, their patron saint. A few days afterwards, we were in Galatina, also in the province of Lecce. Having read about a chapel which the Tarantati visited as part of their healing, I was eager to see this chapel, and I was advised to ask one of the participants where it was. He immediately pointed it out, and interestingly, this young man, despite being in his 20s, happened to have been a first-hand witness to the healing of a Tarantata in the chapel when he was a child. He described how a carpet had been spread out on the chapel floor and how the woman, in an apparently unconscious state, had been brought in. Thereafter, she became increasingly agitated and emitted loud shrieks. When describing the scene, the young participant from Galatina confessed, "I still get a shiver down my spine when I remember that scene," highlighting a more somber aspect of the phenomenon. I will unpack these two contrasting anecdotes as I go along. However, it will be readily clear that there is a stark contrast between the two comments. with the first case emphasizing the liberatory, enjoyable aspect of Celentine music and dance, and the other highlighting terrible suffering and the memory of an oppressive past. And yet these two poles need to be reconciled, just as the words of a song about indescribable pain could be sung to an upbeat melody. In this paper, I intend to discuss the contemporary revival and reinvention of traditional music and dance in Salento, particularly with regard to the way in which this has acted as a platform for the assertion of autonomous local identity. This revival, intrinsically selective and creative, and often resulting in a romanticized and tourist-oriented presentation of the area, which locals call a postcard Salento, un Salento da cartolina, may seem at first glance to fall squarely within the framework of the literature on the invention of tradition. Nevertheless, there are two important aspects of this revival which require further analysis. The first aspect is that, partly due to these folk revivals, Salentini have come to conceive of their society more strongly than ever as an object of direct reflection and critique, a process which I shall term social reflexivity. Furthermore, although continuous references are made to tradition, history, and culture, none of the Salentini I have spoken to have shown any desire to postulate either an unbroken continuity with the past or to turn back the clock and reproduce it wholesale. On the contrary, a certain rupture with the past, a past indeed often colored by oppression, poverty, and suffering, is essential to the narratives of local identity. Here, the distinction made by Lowenthal between history and heritage offers a much more fruitful analysis in this respect. So does the literature, ironically enough, on detraditionalization, which can be used to highlight the ways in which Salentini are deliberately selective in which aspects of the past they bring to their present lives. The second aspect is that this reflexive project amounts to a rethinking of the relationship of the periphery to the center and of the hegemonic narratives that have been imposed on it. Thus, the periphery becomes an active agent, in the words of Franco Cassano, who develops Albert Camus' notion of thought at the meridian. The South is to be given back its ancient dignity of subject of thought, thus breaking a long sequence in which it has been thought out by others. It is also to be noted that in this perspective, the social dynamics at play in Salento become highly relevant to our understanding of peripheries on a broader scale, including the wider region of southern Italy, the Mediterranean, as well as the global margins. And we start with approaching the territory in question. So, Salento is an area in the southernmost part of the Italian region of Apulia, covering the entire province of Lecce, as well as parts of the provinces of Brindisi and Taranto, as you can see in the map behind me. It has been inhabited since prehistoric times and was the home of the Messapi, a people probably of Illyric origin, the area which would now be Albania. Throughout its history, Salento has been a borderland. In Roman times, it marked the end of the Appian Way, which ended, in fact, in Brindisi. At the time of the Crusades, the area was an important point to the itinerary of the Middle East, earning the city of Otranto the title of Porta d'Oriente, Gateway to the Orient. Although it must also be said that this naturally made the area particularly prone to attacks from across the Adriatic. And in fact, these two pictures taken from two different churches. The first picture is from a medieval fresco in a church in Galatina, Santa Caterina d'Alessandria. And there you can see that clearly Adam and Eve are not eating an apple, but a date palm, a date from a date palm. So this painting shows the influence of the Middle East on this area. The second picture is a bit more somber. Those are the relics of the 800 martyrs of Otranto. So all those bones and skulls are the result of a massacre that took place in the Middle Ages in a battle between Muslims and Christians. With the advent of the Counter-Reformation, Jesuit missionaries in the 16th century referred to the area in question as l'India di Quaggiù, the Italian Indies, and they claimed that anybody who would manage to endure a mission in these lands could easily face the hardship of preaching in the New World. Closer to our times, one could say that Salento was part of that world described by Carlo Levi when exiled in the neighboring Basilicata, that is, the world where Christ had not yet set foot, having stopped further north at Eboli. Salento has a remarkably vast repertoire of traditional music, and it's very interesting that the term used for traditional music in Italian is musica popolare, the music of the people. Obviously, pop music in English would mean something completely different. This repertoire includes religious songs, songs of love and disdain, playful storinelli, moroloia or funerary laments, lullabies, and canti alla stisa, polyphonic songs without instrumental accompaniment, which were traditionally sung while carrying out manual work. It is worth mentioning at this point that Salento has two dialects, Salentino, which is an Italian dialect from the same family as Neapolitan and Sicilian, and Greco, a dialect of Greek, still spoken in a number of villages of the area known as the Grecia Salentina, and that this latter dialect comprises its own musical repertoire. At this point, I'd like to play some sound clips from recordings made in 1954 by the two ethnomusicologists Alan Lomax and Diego Carpetella, an American and an Italian ethnomusicologist, respectively.
Buonasera per te case, ma buono tutte sta abitanti, ma buono tutte sta abitanti.
Bene Cristo, ma con le santi, ne desce aiuto e salvazione.
That clip was Lulazzaru, which is a religious narrative song that was, and still is actually, traditionally sung during Holy Week and particularly on Good Friday. This was, in fact, in the Salentino dialect. However, there is a similar song in Greco, and it almost has the same words, but in a different, practically in a different language.
Carine mera, nasa si boca, nasa scontesto, ma di passione, ya vossa vade. Se già Cristo, ma che cose dedi, ya devozione.
Gente se le onta, ciò va a crederno, ya va a sarve.
So, you can see the sound is very different. In this case, we have also polyphonic singing, which is a hallmark of the music of Salento. The next one I'm going to play is also features polyphonic singing. In fact, this is one of the canti alla stisa, the songs that were played, were sung at work, so there's no musical accompaniment. This, in particular, was sung by tobacco, by the people who worked in the tobacco fields. And, in fact, the first few words are deceptively simple, in a way. The first few words said, women, you go to the tobacco fields in twos and come back in fours. And this is a very veiled reference to the possibility of sexual violence in the tobacco fields, which again ties in with the oppression there was in the past in many situations. Something more performative. Keeping the clips short, just to give you a good taste of the of the various type of songs in the repertoire. This was called Sutakwa Sutayentu. It is a love song describing how two people in love could deal with all sorts of tribulations, and they are being they are being said to resemble two oranges hanging on a tree and resisting water and wind. The next one is Amoroloia, which is a funerary lament. So this is in fact a moroloya. In Salento there was the tradition of having prefica, women who would go to weep at funerals, and this was one of the songs that that would be sung. Something more cheerful, Stornello. Stornelli are they are a botta risposta, a bit like the Anna Spiritu Pront. So you can see how there are two singers answering each other. And this could easily go on for very long. However, possibly the most popular genre of Salentine music today is, well, actually not possibly, but doubtlessly, the pizzica. And for now, I'll just play one of the pizzica that were recorded by Alan Lomax and Diego Carpetella, rather than play a revived version. That was a pizzica, which is characterized by a 6/8 rhythm. As you saw, it was a very lively song, and in fact, it had the word pizzica itself means pinch or bite, which will now tie in with the phenomenon of Tarantism. However, the pizzica were played in and performed in various social settings. I mean, first of all, it was performed in a social setting, in a festive setting, as is in this picture, basically. This is a photo I took in 2007. However, pizzica as a festive and ludic dance has a very long history, especially at weddings, family gatherings, harvest festivals, and so on. The second case, now, here, some literature calls this pizzica scherma, which is a very questionable term, in the sense that this dance originates actually from a duel. In fact, some sources indicate that it used to be a duel to the last blood with real knives. In our times, it is, and this was up to a few decades ago, actually. However, in these days, this is played only in one feast, the Feast of San Rocco and Torre Paduli, and it is characterized in its public format. It is always danced by two men, with two fingers in each hand. They mimic the movements of knives, and it is almost a mimicked duel. In fact, some people have compared this to capoeira, which is a martial art disguised as a dance. I have a small video clip of Skerma. The reason I said that it is questionable whether one can actually call it Pizzica Skerma is because even though in its current format it has the sound of the pizzica, actually it has a bit of a slower rhythm, the dance is actually a duel, so it comes from a totally different point than the pizzica itself. And even today, it can be the skerma can be held without the accompaniment of the tambourines. But was this karma? Actually, if you heard the word canalia, that is actually somebody's nickname. It wasn't an insult. And finally, there is tarantism. And tarantism is a complex phenomenon that goes back at least to the 14th century. It is an illness, as I said, it used to be ascribed to a venomous spider or sometimes a snake, a scorpion. Sometimes even a dog who had been bitten in turn by a venomous spider. However, it was characterized by the person going into a very troubled state, sometimes unconscious, and the only things they would react to would be music, colors, and in fact, colored ribbons were used in these rituals. And what I'm going to show now is a clip from a 1962 documentary by Gianfranco Mingozzi. The crisis of the tarantata goes in different phases, and each case was practically unique. However, there were two phases which would alternate. This phase which we are seeing, the person is rolling on the ground. So in a way, it is the taranta, the venomous spider that bit the person, that is winning right now.
Il suo pensiero si muove in ritmo puro e nel movimento quasi meccanico sorgono figure di liberazione, a volte però ancora da ombre di strade.
Okay. I'll fast forward to another part where there's another phase, the other phase, where the woman actually rises, and that is where the woman is winning and is winning the battle.
Passo su passo cerca il suo equilibrio spirituale, accerchiando le origini su curve musicali sempre più vibranti, fino alla scomparsa dei sensi.
What would happen afterwards is that on the 28th June, which is the eve of the feast of Saint Peter and Saint Paul, the tarantata would experience what is called remorso, which can mean remorse, but in the local dialect it actually meant remorso, re-bitten. So the whole experience of having been bitten would come on them. They would have the same symptoms. and they would have to go to Galatina, particularly to visit the chapel, which I mentioned in the beginning. So. So one thing you'll notice here is the absence of music, except for some singing. This was because the church had actually prohibited music from being played in the church. At that point, you can see that the crisis is much less rhythmical than it was in the house, and it becomes much more chaotic, much more. It does not have any. Much more unpredictable. It has no form of pattern in this case. In fact, it is interesting to note that up to the 17th century, Tarentism was not just a peasant phenomenon as it was after the 19th century. It was essentially limited to the peasant classes. However, before that, it extended to the nobility, it extended to the clergy, so much so that the church, not being able to control it, associated it with the cult of Saint Paul, which here in Malta we obviously know. There's the story of the snake. So his territory kind of expands to cover all sorts of venomous creatures. And he is the patron saint of the Tarantate, so even in their trances they would engage in a dialogue with Saint Paul, sometimes fighting. It was a bit of a love-hate relationship with the saint, until they could, in a way, negotiate their healing with the saint. So, the current revival, how did it go from this scenario to this scenario? The picture I'm showing is from La Notte della Taranta, which is one of the greatest, it is probably the greatest concert of ethnic music in Europe. It is definitely one of the largest Italian concerts. It started in 1998. With an attendance of about 5,000 people. In 2008, it had a record of 150,000 people. So we're talking about a massive event here. Now, actually, La Notte della Taranta comprises a series of concerts. Most of them are relatively small, attracting a few thousands. The attendance would vary according to who would be playing. As a concert, it winds its way through the towns of the Grecia Salentina. In fact, as a concert, it is organized by the Union of the Comuni of the Grecia Salentina, the area where there is characterized by the presence of the Greek dialect. And however, now it has expanded also to Galatina because of the connection with Tarentism, to Lecce because it is the capoluogo of Salento. It's the main city of Salento. So it is a concert in constant. However, it culminates in this massive concert. They call it a concertone, a mega concert, which, as I said, now attracts. In the last year, it was about 120,000. So there has been a slight decline in the past few years, but not. We're still talking about huge numbers here. As a concert, it has probably been the most successful one, but it has also been the most controversial one. And the reason is that there are many reasons, actually. One of them is that the maestro concertatore has never been somebody from Salento, so there is a bit of a patriotic complaint about that. However, there is also a stylistic grounds for arguing against that, in the sense that if you are bringing in people from other parts of Italy to conduct this concert, and if you are bringing in pop stars to sing the traditional songs of Salento, a lot of the hallmarks of traditional music, such as polyphonic singing, are completely ignored. So it has been criticized as producing a music that is ostensibly traditional music from Salento, but in actual fact, it follows the canons not of traditional music from Salento, but of, for example, pop music or something else. However, this was actually part of the deliberate ethos of La Notte della Taranta. The organization have always emphasized fusion with other styles, and this is not limited to this particular concert. I mean, there is now versions of traditional music from Salento mixed with all sorts of styles, from reggae to dubstep to Balkan music. However, what needs to be said as well is that this concert was one of the prime movers in the area to, first of all, remove a veil of shame that was unjustly imposed on traditional music, upon the Greek dialect, and all these things that were part of the peasant world. This all has to be taken in the context of Italy in the 60s, which, particularly in the south, was being there was a whole emphasis on modernization. So all these things were things of the past that we would need to leave behind to be able to progress. It was only in the 70s that things slowly started, and actually they culminated in the 1990s. In the 70s, it had a very limited following, mostly by academics and left-wing activists. They were basing their work particularly on Gramsci's notions of subaltern classes. Another thing is that it has, La Notte della Taranta has also introduced Salento's music, and by extension Salento itself, to other parts of Italy and also to other countries. So nowadays you have concerts of traditional Salento music in as far-flung corners as China on one hand to New York on the other. And surprising, well, I mean, not surprisingly, actually, but this year, Salento was voted as the best loved territory by Italians, surmounting such tourist hotspots as the Ligurian Cinque Terre and the Amalfi Coast. I would like to move on to three particular events that were very helpful to me in my fieldwork, and which somehow will bring out the contrasts that I'm talking about. Two of them are time-honored feasts. They are the Feast of San Rocco in Torre Paduli, held on the 15th and 16th of August, and the Feast of Saints Peter and Saint Paul in Galatina, held on the 28th and 29th of June. The other one is, in fact, La Notte della Taranta, which is not, I mean, it is not much time-honored. I mean, it is only 15 years old. However, I will argue that in some respects, La Notte della Taranta has assimilated elements that you find in these village feasts. So, the Feast of Torre Paduli here, the patron saint is San Rocco. As I said, it has been characterized by the skerma, and the issues that came out a lot in this area. Here we are talking about Torre Paduli is the fraction of a village called Ruffano, which has, I think, in all, including Ruffano, it would be a population of a few thousand. The funny thing about all this is, even with La Notte della Taranta, Melpignano, we are talking about a village of about 1,000, a population of about 1,000 people. So we are talking about very small villages hosting large events. In the case of the Feast of San Rocco, as opposed to La Notte della Taranta, what we have is a time-honored feast with which a lot of people perceive as authentic, and they want to keep it that way. In fact, even with the Scherma is not as widely practiced as the Pizzica. In the case of the Scherma, there are very definite rules, and apparently in the past, the young people have tried to improvise. Sometimes they used moves from Oriental martial arts films in the Scherma, which led to a lot of the older people who used to take part in them to just completely disassociate themselves with it and move on. So Torda Paduli here, there is a lot of conservationist approach. It is also a religious feast, so there is also the element of tension between the religious, the church aspect, and the ludic aspect. In fact, this is a cartoon from the parish magazine in that place, where San Rocco is telling his dog companion, basically, he's telling them the crowd that comes to me is filled with the love of wine and with ecstasy, which is a pun that is hardly unintended. And in fact, in the picture, what you see is a ronda, the circle with two people dancing. Now, whether that is the Scherma or whether it's the Pizzica, it is very hard to tell from this rudimentary drawing. However, the message is very clear. Also, traditionally, so why is some people argue that the dances themselves are changing? Some people have gone a step further and said the feast is essentially a religious feast. The dances were just something on the side. So even the fact that now the dances seem to be central, it's a deviation from the way it was in the past. Some elements still show you that it is essentially a religious feast, in the sense that, for example, the dancing should start once the statue has been taken out into procession and come back into the sanctuary, and it should end as soon as the first mass begins. Nowadays, the dances just go on in the morning, so the mass begins, the dances still go on. This is Galatina, and this is that small chapel you saw in the film. Thankfully, one of the positive aspects of this interest in Salento and Tarantism in these traditions is that these paintings have been very recently restored. So when I went in 2004, the painting was almost invisible. It was so dark that that you could hardly make out what there is. The painting there is the titular painting in that chapel, and in fact in the documentary by Mingozzi you saw that Tarantata going up on the altar to speak directly face to face with the saint through this painting. The other one is a well that is behind the chapel that is said to have been blessed by Saint Paul and which the Tarantata used to drink from. It has been decorated in this case with colored ribbons. The colored ribbons have a large part to play in the cure for Tarantism, but the decoration of the well is actually something very recent. This is a detail from the painting in the church, where Saint Paul at his feet has three animals. The first one is the spider, which cannot be seen very well. The second one is the scorpion, the third one is the snake. So these are the three creatures that were generally credited with causing the crises of Tarantism. However, it has been determined by Ernesto De Martino, whose book La Terra del Remorso remains the unsurpassed ethnography about Tarantism, that everything indicates to the fact that the symptoms of Tarantism are completely autonomous from an actual spider bite. So even if there were a few cases where there was a spider bite involved, this would still not be enough to explain the Remorsi, the cyclical crises on the 28th of June. So what to make of that? Basically, it is now the general view that Tarantism was actually an expression of existential crises, of forced marriages, of sexual abuse. So this also brings to light another reason why Tarantism was something that people were not very willing to speak about, because until recently, I mean, nowadays everybody's talking about it, but until the 1990s, people were very reluctant to speak about that. One of the people I interviewed told me, here, people were ashamed of everything, let alone of having a tarantato in your family. So even though there was this whole ritual around it, and even though there was a degree of social acceptance, there was still a veil of shame over it. This is another detail from the painting, which is interesting. Two women healing this man who seems to be a tarantato, actually, and they are giving him water to drink, probably the water from the well behind the chapel. And this is the statue of St. Paul in the feast. One interesting addition was that this was from my fieldwork in 2007. For the first time, they placed a sheaf of wheat at the feet of the saint. The sheaf of wheat, when I asked what it represented, they told me it is just una fantasia della fiorista, just the florist's creativity. However, the wheat itself has a very definite role to play in Tarantism. Generally, people claimed they had the first bite when they were collecting tobacco leaves or when they were collecting, when they were gathering the wheat harvest. And part of the ritual cure was to place things connected to that first episode around the tarantata. This is a painting by an artist, by a local artist from Galatina, Luigi Caiuli. His paintings, obviously, as you can see, portray Tarantism in a very frank manner, in a very sexual manner even. It brings to light the sexual crisis that was very often behind the episodes of Tarantism. And this painting is one of a collection that was launched in an exhibition called 40 anni dopo De Martino, 40 years after De Martino. And it was one of the first movements that started bringing these things not to public knowledge, because people actually knew about them, but to make them a subject that can be discussed openly. This is also a photo that I took from my 2007 fieldwork. Tarantism is now, thankfully, an extinct phenomenon, and I say thankfully because it is a phenomenon that, after all, has a history of suffering and oppression. However, there are still a few old people who were tarantata in the past and still make their pilgrimage to this chapel on the 28th of June. And that red ribbon, I'm not sure about the gold ribbon there, but the red ribbon was definitely left by an ex-tarantata. This is a leaflet that was being handed out in Torre Paduli. As I said, in Torre Paduli there is a very distinct emphasis on keeping things authentic. And this includes such advice as to respect the devotees of Saint of San Rocco and to respect the fact that it's a religious feast, not to play djembe close to the ronde, which was actually a very real problem because the sound of a djembe is much louder than the sound of a tamburello, of an Italian tambourine, so it would usually just completely eclipse the sound of the ronde. To respect some of the rules of the ronde, and I think this is one of the most interesting pieces of advice that have been given here, which is only two people can dance at a time in a ronda. The ronda is not a dance floor. So I think that highlights also the way that people often approach these dances nowadays as purely a means of entertainment. So I would like to go over these three events, and as you can probably see, they demonstrate a number of concerns, among which issues of authenticity and commercialization feature strongly. Although, as can be seen from the accounts given, various individuals hold different positions on these issues. In particular, for example, in Galatina was quite late at catching up with this revival. And there are two very definite reasons for this. First of all, Galatina is a city. So they traditionally felt they were somewhat above the peasant classes. One of the people I interviewed from Galatina, she told me, here we try to be sophisticated, politi is the word she used, which is very similar to the way we use it in Maltese. Here we try to be sophisticated, but trying to be sophisticated, you can even die of hunger. When I interviewed two other people, two young men from Galatina, I asked them, do you think this whole thing is becoming too commercialized? And they told me, no, we actually wish it were more commercialized. We should have been doing La Notte della Taranta here, not in Melpignano. La Notte della Taranta would not exist if not for this small chapel we have here. So as you can see, this debate about commercialization is not, it's very interesting because there are different sides to it. And in a way, it is interesting to compare. It might sound a bit blasphemous, but it is interesting to compare the Feast of Terracaduli and La Notte della Taranta. I'm taking the Feast of Terracaduli as the most authentic one and La Notte della Taranta as the most commercialized one. However, even though they are extremely different in nature, they paradoxically share some interesting similarities, like the Night of San Rocco. The Night of the Taranta is held in August, in the peak tourist season. Basically, in Italy, the peak tourist season is August. The Feast of Galatina in June is off-peak, so it was mostly attended by locals. Entrance to La Notte della Taranta, like any village feast, has always been free of charge, and the concerts are generally held in small towns, thus likening this festival more to village feasts than to the large music concerts that take place around the world. After the concerts at La Notte della Taranta have finished, people form spontaneous ronde. Ronde are people gather in a circle playing the tambourine, and you have two people dancing the pizzica in the middle. It was a bit like this photo, in fact, a photo of a ronda. Yes, so after the concert, people generally just, actually some people say the concert starts when the concert ends, because when the concert ends, that is when people gather with their tambourines, and that, for a lot of people, that's actually where the real fun begins. And they go on until the early hours of the morning. So, yes, another similarity is that in a way, La Notte della Taranta has served in a way as a form of a secular pilgrimage for tourists. In fact, it is very interesting that in 2005, in the official blog, the image of the various towns and cities where the concerts were held were connected by a spider's web, so linking the territory to, which is actually something very interesting, because a lot of people who visit Salento say that the place itself feels like a giant spider web in the sense of the way the villages are connected to each other. However, obviously, there are very important differences. The Feast of Terracaduli has a history that goes back several centuries. La Notte della Taranta is clearly an invention of relatively recent date. Nobody refers to La Notte della Taranta as a tradition unless they are speaking figuratively or in jest. Moreover, although ritual elements, particularly the verses sung in the cure of Tarantism and the ubiquitous symbol of the spider, are used in La Notte della Taranta as well as in countless revival events of recent origin, these are disembedded from their traditional context and are interpreted innovatively. On the other hand, in the Feast of San Rocco, the use of music and dance is embedded in a wider context regulated by time-honored rules, and is thus sought out by locals, researchers, and tourists as being a more authentic celebration than La Notte della Taranta. a particular case that highlights how the Feast of San Rocco is sought out as a more authentic alternative is that of Carmela, a woman in her 40s with whom I spoke during the feast in 2006. Carmela's from Bari, also in Apulia, but further northern Salento, and has attended the Feast of San Rocco every year since first learning to dance pizzica at a dancing course 5 years before. She is very passionate about being true to tradition. Thus, when someone was playing the zampogna, or southern Italian bagpipe, she was somewhat annoyed because while it is a traditional instrument, it is seldom used within the context of the Feast of San Rocco and that of pizzica in general, where tambourines and mouth organs would have been more appropriate. While Carmela said she liked some of the smaller concerts of La Notte della Taranta, she expressed a strong dislike to the mega concert. She described the fusion of traditional music with other styles offered at the mega concert as music that has been raped, musica violentata. For Carmela, the Feast of San Rocco is a space of authentic tradition that has not yet succumbed completely to commercialization and where she can dance the pizzica in an environment that is more genuine than other occasions. Sabrina, a young woman from Lecce but whose family comes from one of the villages of the Grecia, was even more pessimistic than Carmela, telling me that even the Feast of San Rocco has been irreparably damaged by tourist impact. Sabrina contrasted the situation of pizzica in Salento to that of the Tamuriata, a dance of the Campania region. The Tamuriata may be, like the pizzica, a festive dance, but is often danced within specific ritual scenarios, particularly Marian feasts, such as the annual pilgrimage to Montevergine and Avellino, on the feast of Mamma Schiavona, the Dark Madonna venerated in the sanctuary there. According to Sabrina, if, for instance, a young woman dances the Tamuriata in some way that is inappropriate, the older musicians would simply stop playing and thus put her in an embarrassing situation. On the other hand, pizzica is often danced in improvised ways, which Sabrina finds disrespectful to tradition. And I quote her, "Today, in the Ronda, they dance the pizzica without knowing how it should be done. For example, the girls often lift their skirts while dancing, something unthinkable in the past, when my grandmother told me that they were not even allowed to show their ankles." Which was confirmed also by Rosa, a woman in her 50s from Castrignano dei Greci, who told me that when her mother was young, she was required to keep her ankles covered while dancing the pizzica, and that her father used to mentally keep count of the centimeters of distance between her and her dancing partner. A very interesting aspect of pizzica is that in the dance, the two dancers can get very close, but they can never physically touch. The most they can do is the woman would have a handkerchief, and at most the handkerchief can be touched, but not more than that. Naturally, the Feast of San Rocco has undergone modifications even prior to its recent expansion and exposure to tourism. The complete transition of the scherma from actual duel to simulated dance is one of the most evident changes. Nevertheless, innovation, which is accepted and even within limits promoted at La Notte della Taranta, is often perceived as a force which needs to be controlled if the Feast of San Rocco is to preserve its traditional character. Giuseppe Gala, for instance, recounts how in the 1970s, some young people used to dance the scherma using gestures from popular oriental martial arts film, and this disappointed several maestri di scherma, older experts, so much so that it led to a situation where many of them stopped dancing the scherma. And that puts this initiative, Proteggiamo Torre Paduli, in perspective. Now, I'll go back to the anecdote at the beginning. The dancer who says, this dance is liberatory, it is energizing, and so on. So what are we to make of that? Is it a matter of whitewashing the past? Is it a matter of invention of tradition? There is a debate on this element of innovation. One thing that you hear a lot of people say is that they have this music in their blood, they have this music in their DNA, and this is in fact, it does not specifically refer to the music, but it's a t-shirt that you would very possibly see people in Salento wearing, saying DNA Salentino. Some people take the view that, for example, Giuseppe Gala takes the view that this does not make sense, culture is not transmitted genetically, so it does not make sense to say you have a type of music in your DNA. On the other hand, Anna Nacci coined the deliberately provocative term neo-tarantismo to address this embodied experience that a lot of people who dance the pizzica say they feel, this intense liberation of logged energy, this psychological freedom that they experience during this dance, and so on. And Nacci says that the massive interest in Southern Italian folk music is indicative of, first of all, a need of diversity and ethnic identities in response to globalization and processes of cultural leavening. This takes place also in the sense that this music is usually produced by people in the street or by small local companies rather than the global musical industry. Moreover, this music offers many young people a sense of liberation, with some people even mentioning words such as catharsis and trance when describing their experience of this dance. According to Nacci, this brings pizzica and similar types of music to their time-honored therapeutic functions, albeit in an altered context. Traditional rural forms of music therefore address new urban forms of oppression, grief, and anguish, without going through further suffering such as the bite, the venom, the perpetual depression, the silence, without yearning for the 29 June in order to relive the cyclical returns of the crisis. Nacci's interpretation relies perhaps too heavily on the therapeutic aspects of pizzica, which, as has been explained, was used in a variety of contexts and not only as a cure for tarantism. Furthermore, it is implied to some extent that music retains an essential quality regardless of the context in which it is played and of the adaptations the music itself undergoes, rather than acquiring meaning through its embeddedness in a social context. However, what Nacci's research ably points out is the way in which many young people who attend pizzica concerts find that music and dance become an embodied experience, which is then interpreted subjectively. Despite this subjective variability, however, there were some definite patterns in the interpretations given. 59% of Nacci's respondents, for instance, qualified the experience as liberatory. Nacci concedes that knowledge of the social history of pizzica often supports such an experience, but states that a good part of her respondents had a very limited understanding of the cultural underpinnings of the dance and of the traditional norms governing their performance. This trend is also reflected in the fact that a significant number of people visiting events such as Notte dell'Atalanta and the Feast of Torre Paduli have limited knowledge of the historical background and performative norms of the pizzica, though this is more typical of tourists than Salentini themselves, and yet participate in the experience of the dance. Nevertheless, while ignorance of the social history of pizzica may not be an impediment to enjoying the dance as an embodied experience, the participation of people who do not possess adequate knowledge of the performative norms of pizzica and events that feature these dances has often resulted in performance and interpretations of traditional dances that do not correspond to the models actually used in the past, and in the most sensitive scenarios, this may be interpreted as a plain lack of respect towards the ritual, as is often the case in Torre Paduli. It should not be readily assumed, however, that a person who lacks a deep knowledge of the pizzica is barred from experiencing strongly felt emotions through the music and dance, nor must such emotions be hastily labeled as fake. As I said, Gala criticizes modern improvised dancers for claiming that this is in their DNA. However, the statement that pizzica is in somebody's blood or DNA, understood metaphorically, is significant and may be understood to express less a biological fact and more the internalized embodied experience that emerges from dancing. For instance, when I asked a man in his 20s from Zollino whether pizzica belonged to Salento or the world, he told me that ultimately it belongs to the world and is part of human heritage, although being closely acquainted with Salentine culture would naturally help one have a much deeper understanding of the pizzica. So there is this element of tension between the very localized interpretation, this is in our DNA. However, there is also the trend to universalize it. And in fact, Luigi Caiulli, the artist, a painting of whom I showed you earlier, said the emotional impact of the pizzica is not something that can be limited to any particular time or place, but is within the DNA of man himself. So here we see the metaphor of DNA being used in a more universal aspect. In fact, this music revival has also helped to build bridges between Salento and other cultures. Sometimes as I said, locally, the people like to make a distinction, especially the people of Salento with the people of Bari, for instance. So in this this photoshopped image, which was on the internet, a distinction is being made between Salento and the rest of the Apulia region. In fact, there have often been instances where Salento tried to gain its regional autonomy. However, on the other hand, this music is often used to create links with other cultures. In fact, one of the people I interviewed told me that this music is important for her because it reminds her that the Mediterranean, before being divided into various countries, was one whole basin. And so, since there is the similar music in Greece, there is similar music in Albania, and on a more general level, this music seems to resound with people from all cultures. It was used as a bridge building mechanism. I think am I running over? Yes. Okay. So I'll go to the notion of social reflexivity. In the past two decades, anthropologists have often engaged in a form of writing that included an appraisal of the field workers' own social influences on the resulting ethnography, which is in fact the field of reflexivity, the specificity and individuality of the observer being acknowledged, explored, and put to creative use. I'm quoting Judith Oakley here. Nevertheless, in the particular case of Salento, what I found is that people, even non-specialists, would deploy certain terminology, tradition, culture, history, that have spread from the academic field into general society. What I found basically is that the people I spoke with were keenly analytical of the Pizzica revival and of the predicament of Salento and Italy in general. What happened here was that this revival, even in its more controversial forms like La Notte della Taranta, served as a springboard for people to discuss their own culture. Now, I'm not saying in any way that people did not do this in the past or that such a thing as an identity of Salento did not exist. However, it is a fact that if such an identity existed, and I'm sure it did, it was not communicated very strongly outside the area. Thus, a lot of people, when, for example, emigrating to the north of Italy or when emigrating to other places, would call themselves Meridionali or sometimes even Sicilians. The most famous case is Domenico Modugno. Everybody thinks he's Sicilian. He was actually from Salento because he himself used to say that he was Sicilian. As a field worker working in this area, my challenge was not to in any way interpret society, because very often the dialogues I engaged with were very explicit about society. There was very little to interpret. It was more a matter of contextualizing it. And when I say contextualizing it, one has to see it in the perspective of a situation where southern Italy has been mostly hegemonized by other forces. In fact, the famous Southern question has been mostly thought about, the answers seem to have been coming from other places. And this is something that, in fact, I met, which is basically that Salentini often express some resentment at the fact that social science is generally perceived as coming from outside Salento. In fact, De Martino, who is a native of Naples, was referred to in one of the texts I consulted as a researcher coming from the north. I mean, geographically it is north, but it is still part of southern Italy. Roberto Raheli, who laments that the Salento phenomenon, I quote here, attracts anthropologists and musicologists interested in studying and observing us as if we had antennas and a green skin. The artist Luigi Caiuli, whom I interviewed in his studio in Galatina, also voiced concern on the interest of foreign anthropologists in Tarantism, stating that there is little that a researcher who is not Salentino can teach Salentini about this phenomenon. And I agree completely with that view. Such statements might appear hostile towards foreign researchers, but cannot be understood simply as a form of local protectionism. Indeed, the reality I experienced in doing my fieldwork was rather different. Not only was I never made to feel unwelcome, but rather the people I interviewed and interacted with were incredibly generous with their time and resources, often going out of their way to help me in their research. These statements rather express resentment at the ways in which the South has often been hegemonically imagined and studied by the more developed Italian and European North. A local saying in the Salentine dialect, now often found printed on t-shirts, may aptly express this resentment. Lasciatemi perdere, me capisco a solo. Leave me alone, I can understand myself. In the past decade, in fact, there has been a dramatic increase in the amount of locally produced literature dealing with Salentine history or traditions. When I asked Giuseppe Ciriatti, who is the very young founder of a publication house called Kurumuni, Kurumuni is a Greek word which means olive seedling, whether he thinks that this is una moda passeggera, a fashion that, whether it will go out of fashion, essentially. He told me, yes, of course, it will go out of fashion, but at least when it does, we have all this literature that has been printed, all this research that has been done. And interestingly, this literary boom is often directly linked to the Pizzica revival. So we have people who are musicians and who do their own research. The books are sold at concerts. The CDs are sold at concerts. Often you find books and CDs together. So an inference that can be made here is that the process of constructing a Salentine identity is not exclusively based on the Pizzica revival, but that renewed interest in traditional music and dance has nevertheless proven a very effective catalyst. I would like to refer to two books that, although academic titles, have reached bestseller status in local bookshops. And in fact, I'm not planning to discuss these books as the academic texts that they are, but rather in what do Salentini find in these texts. The first one is Ernesto De Martino's The Land of Remorse, La Terra del Remorso. As I said, the word remorso has two meanings, and it is hard to bring out in translation. The other is Franco Cassano, Il Pensiero Meridiano. What is interesting is that both of these texts, although focusing in the case of De Martino specifically on Salento, in the case of Cassano on southern Italy in general, both of these texts say that their conclusions on the areas in question are applicable to wider levels. So when Ernesto De Martino said that the land of remorse is Puglia, the land of a wretched past which returns and regurgitates and oppresses with its regurgitation, he said that ultimately the land of remorse is not only Puglia, but also southern Italy, and in a yet broader sense, our whole planet, or, I quote, at least that part of it which has entered the shadow cone of its wretched past. On the other hand, Franco Cassano's Il Pensiero Meridiano, which promotes an understanding of the South on its own terms rather than as an undeveloped version of the North, this has been influential not only amongst southern Italian social scientists, but also enjoys a cult following among lay people. In fact, it has been credited as being one of the texts that has sparked La Notte della Taranta and this revival in a more general sense. And Franco Cassano himself wrote about this current revival as almost the empirical proof of what he wrote. So there is a very interesting cross-pollination between academia and performance in this area. And Franco Cassano, in fact, also says that when he talks about the South being given its autonomy, its intellectual autonomy, the South being able to become a subject of thought, to think itself rather than allow itself to be taught by the North, again, he applies that to the Italian South, the European South, the Mediterranean, or the global South as well, so it has a more global perspective. these two texts, side by side, not only as an academic writing, but as a product of their time, seem to outline the poles of the situation at hand, both for Salento as well as on wider levels. That is, that identities are created in the delicate balance between a haunting past that insists on asserting itself and a postmodern world that beckons. As has been shown, the management of Salentine heritage and the construction and assertion of a Salentine identity are interconnected in a number of ways. That the management of heritage involves a selective approach to tradition does not imply that Salentini are in any way deluded about their history. Rather, Salentini are keenly aware that the creation of their identity need not be based on an attempt to return to a wholesale reproduction of the past. Furthermore, both in conversations as well as in the steady stream of literature that has emerged from the phenomenon, they show themselves to be strongly conscious of the links between the management of their heritage and the construction of their identity, and understand that both are intrinsically contentious and political processes. This must also be understood within the context of a rapidly changing situation in which the hegemony of the Italian and global north over the Italian and global south is being increasingly challenged, not least of which within the intellectual sphere. Finally, if the self in the postmodern world is the result of a reflexive project, then the construction of a Salentine identity based on a consciously selective approach to history and an integration of diverse social influences can hardly be an isolated example and may therefore be significant in an even wider context than that outlined above. Okay.
Thank you very much, Michael, for a fascinating discussion. I'm sure there's a number of questions that people want to ask you on different aspects of Tarantismo. I just want to ask one question, I think. It strikes me that this is not merely a complex phenomenon, but an increasingly complex phenomenon. At the same time, I'm aware that one must avoid ethnocentricity in explaining this or seeking an explanation, because Italian popular culture is well known for being highly articulate. Jeff Pratt, for example, in his book about Italian peasants, points out just how rich and articulate their discussions of economic and political crisis are. So I think we're dealing with a society which, even in its rural forms, is very articulate indeed. Having said that, I guess my question goes like this. Are there two layers in this? That is to say, using as dimensions rural, urban, and young, old, is the very, very local village celebration something rural and aging vis-a-vis these 100,000 mob events where what you're looking at is something young, urban? I'm not saying by urban non-Pugliese. I'm saying it could still be Pugliese. It could even, I don't know, you'd have to tell me about the population of Salento, but it could be of towns in that region. But is there a kind of town versus countryside, old versus young dimension to the big events versus the small events?
Yes, definitely. Even within the area of Salento, there is a distinction between villages and towns or cities, and very often it is mostly a cultural difference rather than, obviously there would be some differences such as population and so on, but in fact, for example, in Galatina it makes a big difference. Galatina was so slow to take up this revival because, primarily because of the fact that it considered itself a city, so it cut itself off from its peasant past. Nowadays, most of the events that take place are taking place in villages, even though sometimes also in even in Lecce itself, and even in other cities. So there would be people of Apulian descent, or even not of Apulian descent, but who just like this music, who would be playing the pizzica in Milan or in Bologna, for example, even though the fact that people travel also to study or to work and they take their music with them, that helps the music to spread around. Now, generally I found I hardly have anything scientific to go by. However, from the people I spoke to, the people in villages tended to feel that it was something that was more theirs, and they were a bit more resistant to see it being changed, even though not in a very academic way, in the sense that their reason for not wanting this music to be changed was not, it was simply, this is the way it has been played in the past, this is the way we have heard it, this is our music, why change it? And in fact, in one of the versions of La Notte della Taranta, Femmina Femmina, which was the tobacco fields song I played earlier, that song was sung by Gianna Nannini, who, an Italian pop star, who originally wanted to make a rock version of it, and eventually decided that the music should not be touched. And obviously, I mean, it did not have the polyphonic song and so on, but the people I spoke to actually praised that version, and they said she made the right decision keeping it as it is. And people still, even though that was in a very, very early edition, people still speak about that version as being particularly, a particularly beautiful rendition. So, yes, there is a difference between people in the cities who do not have this as their personal family background, perhaps, even though they are from the area. So they were introduced through this revival movement, this movement in Italian, the revival movement is called Movimento di Riproposta. They are proposing this music anew. So I think that would be the major difference between the rural and urban areas, even within Puglia itself.
Thank you, Michael. That's really, really passionate, very interesting. I really loved it. Just two or three questions. I'm trying to, because obviously our team of research are quite close. So, I read Ernesto De Martino when I was a young student, so I don't remember it very well. But if I remember well, what he was saying was that the church was already transforming the tarantella and thinking it over and making it in a way more sad because there is no music, and you know, so actually just to say that maybe it has been evolving since centuries, and that actually that now they are only dancing without the church might not be so unauthentic. It might, you could see it also as a coming back, you know. That's just one idea. And then also I was wondering, is it only for women? It is, no? Or mainly?
Tarantismo?
Yeah.
It is not only for women. However, the vast majority were women. In fact, that was one of the vital clues for De Martino to conclude that it was not related to a spider bite, because since men participated more in agricultural work, if it were really a matter of being bitten while cutting tobacco leaves or while harvesting grain, the expectation would have been to have more men than women. However, it was by no means an exclusively female domain. I mean, there were many male tarantati.
But thinking if it is mainly for women, and since now with this new trance version of tarantella is danced by men a lot, by young men, and it seems that, you know, like this concert, it's almost like it's not only a fight between urban and country or between old and young, but maybe there is also a gender issue where women are saying, like you were quoting two women who've learned by the book kind of how to dance, like you say, they follow a course and then they say, no, this is the way it should be, you know, because also they're losing something, I guess. They're losing a kind of, not only, but let's say generally a feminine ritual. And then the last bit, just I'm sorry, but
no.
I would love to speak with you more. Is this thing of the, you know, always the intimate and the outside, and when you, this is for cooking, it was a bit the same idea also, where when you have a ritual which is done at home, mm-hmm. you know, in a closed, you're saying that people were very ashamed of it before, so it was something really intimate and hidden. And now, big concert, or even if it's with the church, but it's outside and everybody sees it, and tourists or people from the region mm-hmm. comes, and that's why then they have to put the rules, they have to write the rules, was before, mm-hmm. when something mm-hmm. intimate, and the transmission is done orally, you don't need to write the rules.
Mm-hmm.
So I think mm-hmm. that's also another dichotomy which could be interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Outside, inside.
All right. Thanks for your interesting comment. About church involvement, yes, definitely. I mean, Tarantismo, as it was witnessed by Ernesto De Martino in 1959 when he did his fieldwork, or by Gianfranco Mingozzi, who made that documentary in 1962. I mean, De Martino states that what he was witnessing was Tarantismo in its dying stages. So prior to the 17th century, it was experienced by the nobility, by the clergy also. In fact, some accounts say that when the church enforced a rule whereby the clergy could not dance, a lot of clergy tarantati thereafter succumbed to malignant illnesses because they could not dance, so they could not expel the poison. there was definitely a lot of church involvement. In fact, I think the church involvement, and on the one hand, especially with the Jesuit missions in the area, together with the Neapolitan Enlightenment, particularly the Salernitan Medical School, those two elements served to diminish a lot the world of Tarantismo. In fact, even musically, by the time that De Martino was writing, what we had were a number of pizzicae with different tempos, different moods, which would... However, before that, the repertoire was enormously more vast. And it included military marches, funerary dirges. The rituals were more complex. Some people had to go in the sea to dance. So even though it was a terribly complex phenomenon in the 1950s, it was a much vaster phenomenon before that. What is interesting is that the church has always had a bit of a tense relationship with Tarantismo. In fact, that is why it placed it under the patronage of St. Paul, and that also changed the way in which Tarantismo was experienced. And St. Paul became incredibly important in the ritual, with the Tarantate speaking to him in visions, and so on. Incidentally, in the year in which I was finalizing my fieldwork in 2007, that small church, because it is very important to note that the church in which the Tarantate used to go is a very small church. In fact, from outside, you wouldn't even recognize it as a church. It just has a normal door. It is not the main church of Galatina. And it is interesting that this church had been deconsecrated. Mass was not being said there. And in 2007, that was the first day, sorry, it was the first year in a long time that Mass was said there in the feast. And in fact, the priest made some comments about Tarantismo, and he said, we are not in a position to say whether these were authentic miracles or not. However, one cannot discount the option. The most important thing is to keep the world of entertainment and the world of religion apart. So that is something about church involvement. About gender, I haven't delved enough in the gender aspect so far, so I don't have many comments to add to that, but it is definitely something to look into. I'm not sure whether Anna Nacci in her research on neo-Tarantismo, whether she made a distinction. However, I know that there is an Italian practicing tarantella courses in New York, of all places. And however, in her courses, apparently, for example, there was one case in which a person had been sexually abused, and this dance, which emerged in a lot of visions, in this case it was a Black Madonna, not St. Paul, interestingly enough. However, this dance and these visions, this person claimed, helped her come out of her. Actually, incidentally, it was a French person in New who the person who does these courses is based in New York, but she does some courses in Europe as well. However, I haven't really looked into that in too much detail. As regards the intimate and external, something that may come as a surprise is that even the domestic ritual had a public aspect. I don't know if you caught that that slight scene where there were a lot of people peering into the doorway of the house. And very often, the Tarantate, St. Paul would, in their visions, tell them, for example, that you have to collect an amount of money and take it as an offering to the church. Now, even if the family were able to provide that money, that would not be acceptable to the saint very often. They would need to be offering. So the person would have to go around asking for that money to collect it. And so there, even in the domestic version, there is a public element. In the festivities in Galatina, there was an immense public element there. It was almost a public spectacle. In fact, strangely enough, even though now there is this debate about whether this revival is being commercialized and whether it is only a tourist phenomenon and so on, this debate was actually going on much earlier with the Tarantate, in that a lot of people said, well, some of the Tarantate are genuine, but most of them are actually just putting on a show, being paid to bring tourists to the feast in Galatina. I'm talking about the 1950s. So even then there was this, obviously in those times tourism was probably people from other towns in Salento. However, there was still the element of spectacle there.
Thank you very much. Very sort of you have a lot of field work there, lots to analyze because there is so much going on. And what interests me though is how from kind of an expression of distress and grief, because obviously some of the pictures that you see, women or the Tarantati are really suffering, and it is an expression of that. So it wasn't just the dance. How did it evolve to become a dance? What happened to the distress? Because obviously there was those were strong feelings. That video, that documentary was rather disturbing. You can see that woman was visibly, you can actually feel it. That is one comment. What happened? Because I'm really interested with sort of mental health, performance and distress, because it still happens. It's that pathological kind of, if we want to look at it from a medical side. Which it wasn't, it was part of the community and they accepted that behavior, like running on the altar, doing those movements which are very provocative and sexual in a very sort of conservative, you know, society or group. What happened? What happened to the distress? How do people in that area express their distress, kind of? Do they have an outlet? And how did it evolve in the new neo-Tarantismo? You know, how is there a vestige left of that?
Just to clarify your question, when you say what happened to the distress to the people who were Tarantate in the past,
and also now, you know, kind of, you know, sometimes there are.
Or what happened to the distress in general?
As you said, with the medicalization of the school, of the Salentino school, with the new whatever those things are, but these people were, you know, expressing their distress through the dance. What happened? What happens now? It's all gone, or is there something which is a reminder of things that were? I don't know if I'm making myself clear.
Interestingly, if sure.
I think these people were stressed and they were depressed mostly, and they were trying to get rid of their depression in this kind of way. But the question is, how did they come on the idea that that dancing would and music would remove their depression? I mean, depression has been around for a long time, and that's why even the rich people used to take part in this kind of ritual to get rid of their depression, because even rich people had depression. And I don't think, what did they used to call it in the olden days? Melancholia.
In fact, some of the songs, some of the pizzica make an explicit reference to malinconia. Se c'è malinconia, caccia la fuori. If there's melancholy, send it out, bring it out. Well, as regards the first question, what happened to the distress? If you ask people, especially people of an older generation, why don't you have any tarantate left? The reason would be a very pragmatic one, actually. They will tell you the spiders have all died with the pesticides. And they would be...
And that's really poignant.
It is. It is. Because in a way, it... In a way, there's much to unpack in that deceptively simple sentence, in the sense that, in a way, poisoning the earth with pesticides has led to the decline of Tarantismo. So it is a bit of a, there's a bit of a dichotomy there. If you ask, For example, the woman who appeared in Gianfranco Mingozzi's, the one in The Domestic Cure, she is the same woman who appears in De Martino's book. She is called Maria Di Nardò. And one of the effects of this research that De Martino started and then was followed up by others was that a lot of people were suddenly interested in this woman. I mean, this woman was just an ordinary woman from a village, and suddenly she had researchers coming to interview her and so on. And then one fine day she told them, I am an ex-tarantata. That is the word that she used. Sometimes they would explain why they don't go through the cyclical crises any longer through a vision. For example, in one case, one of the tarantata that De Martino interviewed said, I saw Saint Paul in a vision, and with his sword he cut the spider's web and killed the spider. And even then, however, there is a very interesting relationship between Saint Paul and the venomous creatures. He is at once the person who can heal you from a venomous bite, but if you offend the saint, he could just as easily send you a spider or a snake to bite you. So, the questions you ask, it is very hard to answer, really. I mean, what happened to, why would these people suddenly feel the need not to dance any longer? That is a very interesting question. However, it is a very hard one to answer. As regards where the idea of dancing came from, that is also a matter of much debate. However, De Martino suggests that it has a pre-Christian origin, which was then, in fact, De Martino says that the Christian church eventually changed it from a dance celebration into an illness. A lot of people, yes, I mean, these frenetic dances are a phenomenon that one finds in a lot of places, especially somehow there is an explosion of them in the Middle Ages. Across Europe, there were the so-called dancing plagues. There are some fairy tales that we still tell our children nowadays that have some vague memory of them, like the Pied Piper of Hamelin or the Red Shoes. However, it was a reality that in a lot of countries across the European continent, there were these dancing plagues. What they were is a whole subject in itself, the history of them. One interesting reference, however, in this regard is actually not by an academic but by a journalist. However, I think she made a very good comprehensive work of it. Barbara Ehrenreich, Dancing in the Streets. It is subtitled The History of Collective Joy. And her thesis, very simply put, is that it is natural for people to dance, to celebrate. In the past, holidays were much more numerous than they are today. Eventually, society changed and melancholy kicked in. It is a very wide historical overview, so it would be perhaps more reliable to have single case studies which go into more detail. However, it is an interesting hypothesis. As regards where did the stress go in a collective sense, that is what Luisa Del Giudice calls the rehabilitation of the Taranta, in the sense that people now tend to associate the stress felt by the Taranta because of their own personal problems with the stress that we all face in our lives. I mean, as urban as we are, as modern as we still have problems, we still face distress, we still suffer from depression, from rage, from unpleasant emotions. And with a lot of young people, in fact, that is their justification, in a way, for dancing the pizzica, that this somehow has a liberatory effect in that sense. And this is where I feel that as academics we have a responsibility not to very clearly, you know, if somebody is not doing is not performing a dance exactly the way it used to be in 1959, to label it as fake. I mean, we can't be naive about these performances. There is definitely a commercial element going there. But in many cases, I found there is also a very deep personal element as well.
Unfortunately, we have to bring this discussion to a close as 8 o'clock approaches. Thank you very much. I think you raised a lot of questions. I think we're dealing with an extremely complex phenomenon, which has multiple meanings. It's a floating signifier. This dance and this it's very very definitely a floating signifier, to which all kinds of meanings are created, which makes it ever the more fascinating to discuss. So, we hope to hear from you again with more research on this. Thank you very much, Michael.
Thanks a lot.